As you know, galaxies are extended objects. They have, you know, a profile, a luminosity profile, etc. But as far as their clustering is concerned, right, there are points on the sky, right? So this is an old map, relatively old, 10 years old map, showing the distribution of galaxies in a slice out to redshift 0.2. And each of these points is a galaxy. And do I have a pointer, by the way? Oh, the ice hockey.
Yes, that
point. Oh, I see. Okay, that's good. Very, very nice. I see. That's because the blue jays. No, blue jays is baseball. Okay, whatever.
Canadian.
What did I want to say? I think the main feature here is that these points are not randomly distributed. Like galaxies cluster, and there is actually a lot of information in how galaxy clusters. And so there has been and there will be many actually galaxy surveys that will try to extract cosmological information out of the galaxy distribution. And some of the main science goals are here listed, for instance, constrain neutrino masses with the matter power spectrum, constrain the dark energy equation of state with baryon acoustic oscillation, test general relativity with achieved space distortions, or probe inflation with the galaxy bispectrum. The main point is that we actually will be looking at tiny deviations from the standard lambda CDM paradigm, right? General relativity, cosmological constant, cold dark matter, we don't know what this is, but you know. And the standard slow of model for inflation. So we need to have a very solid understanding of how galaxy actually clusters in the universe if we want to, you know, get significant improvement on constraints. So it turns out that galaxies are not distributed as the matter, at least in the cold dark matter paradigm. And let me first illustrate so the idea of bias with this figure. So here you have actually two distributions, right? You have the distribution of land, okay, immersed land, which is like all these continents, right? And you have the distribution of light. The main point of this figure is to tell you that the distribution of light clusters differently than the distribution of light, and that's what I mean by bias. It's actually the fact that galaxies will cluster differently than the mass in the universe. So let's leave this figure behind us and move to something which is a bit more closely related to cosmology. And here is a slice extracted from an n-body simulation. So this slice, which is roughly 1,000 megaparsec size, shows a distribution of dark matter at redshift 0 in an n-body simulation. And so the color code is the following. The brighter the color, so the yellow, the higher the overdensity. And so what you actually observe is that the dark matter that is simulated in this n-body simulation does not cluster randomly, but because of gravity, you get filaments, and then at the nodes of these filaments, where you have a lot of here of overdense region, then you get actually structures to virialize and to form dark matter halos. And it turns out that the gas that is not simulated here will actually collapse into these dark matter halos, these potential wells, cool down and form stars and galaxies. So actually, the galaxies will form at the nodes of this. At the nodes along these filaments, right? So they will be distributed differently than the dark matter simulated in this n-body simulation. So there will be a bias between the distribution of galaxies and that of the dark matter. Now, actually, in the remaining of this talk, I won't go into galaxy bias because it's very complicated, right? Because you have a dependence on luminosity, colors, and all that. But because, as I just told you, I know what I expect is that galaxies form in dark matter halos, then the first step towards understanding the bias of galaxies is understanding the bias of dark matter halos. Okay, so that's what I will try to describe in what follows. So how do we model halo or galaxy biasing theoretically? Well, the simplest way is to do the following. So you take random spheres in the universe, okay, in your simulated volume, and you count the amount of mass in these random spheres, and you compare this amount of mass, so this overdensity in mass, with the overdensity of dark matter halos in the same volume. And you will find that at first order, the two do not agree. Of course, there is a bias. And at first order, This can be modeled with a simple bias parameter, which we call the linear halo bias. Okay, so the halo of a density in certain spheres, okay, is proportional to the galaxy, to the dark matter of a density. That's the first order description, and this was put actually, this was pointed out 30 years ago by Nick Kayser in a famous paper. He's actually the first who coined the term bias. So if you want to make accurate theoretical predictions, you have to go beyond this linear bias model. So there is something which is widely used these days, which is the local Lagrangian bias model. So what basically you do is that you start with similar considerations. You consider spheres, okay, in your universe. You count the number of halos, which you use to define the hover density of halos. And then you count the mass of a density in these spheres. And then you write down basically a bias expansion. Okay, so you extend this bias, linear bias, to higher orders. So what I did here is that you see here I have the halo of a density. And here I have the mass, the dark matter of a density, if you wish, okay, in these spheres. I put a R just to tell you that that's the over density in spheres of radius, commoving radius R. Okay. And then I have these coefficients, bias parameters, that I write down arbitrarily. The assumption here is that these bias coefficients, so here you have the linear bias, quadratic, third order bias, they only depend on halo mass, you know, first approximation. They don't depend on scale, yes?
Function on the left is a discrete function because of course halos are discrete, but some of them are functions. But on the right is a continuous function. So in some sense, this cannot be exactly valid unless you are smoothing the left.
Right, absolutely. So halos are these are points as far as this clustering is concerned. I will come back to this actually. That's one of the main points of this talk. Right? But I mean, you could still define the continuous function, right? You could throw spheres. You know, you choose a point in the universe and you define this point as the center of your sphere. And then you count the number of halos within radius R of this point. And then you move the point smoothly, you know, in the universe. And this will define a smooth field, right?
So the left-hand side is also a smooth field. Right?
Yes. So that's also a smooth field, okay? If you think of this that way, okay?
So then there are different smoothing scales for the...
So here, there should also be a scale which would be R. I just didn't write it down to avoid, you know, AV notations, but...
The same R,
exactly. But this is understood here, actually, okay? There is an additional scale if you want to define things that way, but you should it's not exactly what you're doing in when you compute a two-point correlation, for instance. When you compute the two-point correlation of galaxies or halos, you're not counting galaxies actually in cells. You're just counting pairs with a given separation. Okay, so here I had to add an additional scale to give some sense to this definition. Okay. That's actually one of the problems, which I want to come back to later. Yes?
Is there any simple physical reason why you'd expect the linear term to be most important? Is it just that you're Taylor expanding a general function?
It's like Taylor expanding a general function. If you assume that the Taylor coefficients are roughly of the same order, and if you take R to be large so that delta R is small, then you expect that the third order term will be negligible compared to the second, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? But of course, you could always be, you know, facing like a weird bias in which the higher order terms are important. But that's basically just Taylor expansion with Taylor coefficients to be fixed.
This could be chaotic as well, in case you have no such expansion. You have a practice.
Right, that's true. And when you have points, actually, you cannot write down something like that. I mean, when you have points, you could think of this like, an average, actually, bias relation, right? But the average of the halo of a density in such cells is described by this relation.
So I guess maybe the point then is that there could be a stochastic paragraph, then this is not...
Absolutely. I could add at the end a stochastic, okay? Or if you don't want to have stochasticity here, think of like some average relation. But that's absolutely true. Right? At the end, I should add that like a stochastic term that describes the fact that when I go from one cell to the other, it can change.
No, I mean, the point is that you could always do regression plot delta S versus delta R, and there is,
So then you would work with the mean, the average of the counts, or the count squared, or things like that, right?
It might be a dispersion around your best fit might be very big. So
I'm not trying to be mathematically or physically precise here. I'm just trying to give you how things work, and then I will refine all this.
Okay.
okay?
So in that sense, there could be a constant there as well.
Well, it could be like a stochastic term at the end that has nothing to do with, you know, the bias parameters that you have here, for instance, or with the fields delta r itself.
But also, I mean, because there's a smoothing scale, so this relation obviously doesn't go all the way to zero. It could be that you have a
well, of course, you realize that there is a problem because at some point when the cell become too small, then it's not well defined. I mean, well, you understood this thing, this equation has many problems, right? Okay, and then I want to go actually beyond and okay, it's good that you pointed yourself the problems, right? But I don't have to do it. What I want to say, one more thing, is that I wrote Lagrangian. What do I mean by Lagrangian? Is that actually I will think of all these things that as being defined in the initial condition. Why? Because, so I'm interested in the clustering of dark matter halos. These dark matter halos, they have idea of the dense regions of the universe now, but I know where they come from, okay? According to the gravitational paradigm, they were actually slightly over dense regions in the initial universe, amplified by gravity, okay? So it turns out that these slightly over dense regions in the initial universe were already biased. Okay, so what I'm writing down here is like I'm writing a bias relation for these slightly over dense regions in the initial universe. And then, of course, what I have to do is that if I write down the Lagrangian bias relation, I need to move everything, you know, forward in time to the final positions, right? So there will be corrections induced by gravitational motions, but I won't focus on this. It's not the point. There is already a bias in the initial condition, right? Okay. And then just to tell you, so once we write down a bias relation like this, how do we compute, for instance, how do we predict a two-point correlation function? Well, we just take the ensemble average of this. And what you get is that at leading order, you will get B1 squared times the correlation of the mass density field smooth on the scale R. Okay? And I'm assuming homogeneity and isotropy, of course, throughout this talk. So what about these bias parameters? So it turns out that these bias parameters are not like random, but they are related to the halo abundance or the halo mass functions. I will illustrate how. So this is an argument which actually was first made by Kayser and in BBKS. Very nice argument. So here how it goes. What I'm here drawing is like a simplified picture of the mass density field. I'm assuming that this mass density field is made up of only one density perturbation of a given wavelength, okay? So it's very simplified, okay? I'm in the initial condition because I'm interested in Lagrangian bias, okay, at the moment. And so on the y-axis, this is the density. And what I'm showing here is that I'm showing the sites where this mass density field crosses some threshold, because what I expect from just gravitational collapse is that whenever the density, the linear density, reaches some threshold, the density perturbation will collapse and virialize to form a dark matter halos at some redshift, okay? So it turns out that you have a prediction for the value of this critical collapse in linear theory, which is 1.68, okay, as you know. But the point is that, I mean, here everything is really perfectly homogeneous. There are basically no perturbations on scales larger than the wavelength of this perturbation. So if I would take cells much larger than the wavelength of the perturbation in this mass density field, then I would find the same over density of halos, so of peaks, okay, in each of these cells. So there is zero over density of halos, okay? It's perfectly homogeneous, okay, if I go to scales large enough. Now, what happens if I put a long wavelength perturbation? Okay, so the long wavelength perturbation that I had to my mass density field will modulate the positions where actually the mass density field becomes larger than the threshold. Okay, so this will create a bias. This will create clustering because now if I take cells centered here on a big overdensity or there on a big void, I will get more or less halos. And there will also be a bias because I will get much less halos here compared to actually the mass of a density in voids, right? Okay? So one way, I mean, the way to translate this, let's say, into like an equation is to say the following. So the over density of halos in a given cell, okay, in the universe, is basically the is basically the number of halos in this cell divided by the average minus one, okay? But I can view this, because of what I just told you before, as it's basically the number, the average number density of halos, but for in at this point x, but for a threshold that is slightly modified with respect to the standard spherical collapse threshold, right? So the long wavelength perturbation like slightly modulate the threshold for collapse, okay? And then I write the same ratio. I assume that the number density of halos only depends on this collapse threshold, and then I just expand Taylor expand this thing, okay? And so we'll get the following expansion. You can do it yourself. So you have derivatives of the halo abundance or halo mass functions. And if you remember, this local Lagrangian bias relation I wrote down here, then I will identify the coefficient with the bias factor. Okay, so the claim is that, well, when, sorry for the colors, but here you have B1. So the claim is that this first derivative of the halo mass function should be equal to the linear halo bias. Second derivative should be equal to the quadratic, et cetera, et cetera. So you expect that there is a relation between quantities that are actually related to the, how halos clusters and the halo mass function, which is just a, like a, just counts one a PDF, right? 1 point PDF. Okay? Any question? So two remarks at this stage. First, to be very generic, I could think of more general expansions, right? I wrote an expansion which depends only on the local, if you want, mass over density, but I could imagine that I could have more terms that would still be consistent with the fact that I need a quantity that is a scalar and that is invariant of the rotation, right? That's the only conditions, okay? So I could add something that depends on the gradient squared, okay, of the density, because this is invariant of the rotation. I could also have something that depends on this trace of a second order tensor squared, all right, that's also invariant, et cetera, okay? And the second point is, what you already pointed yourself, is the fact that halos are actually discrete, right? So does this matter in all what I said, beyond the fact that I expect a Poisson-Schott noise term in the halo or galaxy power spectrum? So that's what I want to come and to discuss now. There is a model, which is the PIC model, which was put forward by Bardin et al., BBKS, in the 80s. And in this model, what they did is that they really tried to take into account the fact that halos or galaxies are points. And so they say that instead of looking at overdense regions, we should look at density peaks, really, the points that are the density maxima of this initial density field, okay? And they use this approximation as a proxy for the formation site of dark matter halos. So how does it go? A bit more in details. So in order to specify the peak constraint, you need to work with the density field, but also with its first and second derivatives, all right? So this is how you write them in this, for convenience. So you will normalize them. So here what I have is the mass density field, which I assume it's smooth on scale RS. Okay, I use some smoothing, okay? Because basically what I expect is that the dynamics that basically controls the collapse of dark matter halos of a given mass M is basically sensitive to scales that are on this mass M and larger, but not scales that are much smaller than this mass M. And that it's basically not sensitive to the substructure distribution of this initial patch, okay? And then I normalize this density field by basically the RMS variance of the linear density field, which is the zeroth moment, zero spectral moments, where the spectral moments are defined as follows. They are basically integrals of the mass power spectrum times powers of k squared. Okay? So this gives me something that has unit variance. And I do the same, okay, for the first derivative and second derivatives. I normalize these things. Okay? And then I need to, you know, prescribe a peak, right? A local density maximum. So what do? I have, first, I want the height, okay, we call this the peak height, the height of this local maximum to be equal to the height predicted by the spherical collapse model, so that I have a halo, virialized halo at a certain redshift in the low redshift universe. Then I want to have a local extremum, okay, here. So I want the first derivative to vanish at the position xp of this peak. And then the third constraint is that I want all the eigenvalues of minus the matrix of second derivatives to be positive, okay, to make sure that the curve here is, I never remember, it's convex or concave, one of them.
So the eigenvalues cannot be convex?
No, they're all real. The matrix is symmetric. Hermitian.
So, but that's a question. So, why do you want to set it exactly equal to the other? It should be bigger than the opposite, right? The height of the peak.
Well, I could take something that is bigger. I will come back to this later in the talk. But I mean, just roughly to set up the scale, okay, of these peaks, because I want them to collapse to form dark matter halos, they should be roughly of the height of that predicted by the spherical collapse model, okay, an expanding universe. So now the question is, is this correspondence that we assume between virialized dark matter halos and initial density maxima, is it a good correspondence? It turns out that people looked at this with numerical simulation and they found recently that this is actually pretty good. So there is a recent work by Ludlow and Porciani. So what they did is the following. They looked for all virialized dark matter halos in their simulation at redshift zero. Then they took all the particles bound to these halos and traced them back to the initial condition. So these red here spots show you the initial distribution of these particles. And all of them will collapse into a single virialized halo at redshift zero. And then they overlaid on top of this the contours of the linear density field to show you where are the positions of the initial density maxima. And you find actually that in most cases, what do I mean? 80% of the dark matter halos with mass equal or larger than 10 to the 13 in their simulation, okay, can be nearly exactly matched to an initial density peaks. Okay? And this shows you two cases where it works well. But they also found cases where it doesn't work. Okay, so these are two cases where it doesn't work well. Okay, what is interesting?
Is the initial field smooth on the same scale as the mass?
Exactly. So it's smooth on the nearly same scale here. Yeah. Or the same, with a top hat filter.
And the yellow contours
are 1.68. So the yellow contours I think defined when you go from negative to positive over densities, and then I don't remember, but it's basically pretty. So it's pretty good for halos, I would say, with mass larger than M star, if you know what is M star, or 10 to the 13, 10 to the 12, okay, for sigma 8 of 0.8. So, this being said, let's go back to our peaks and you know, try to compute some statistics with this, okay? So, in order to compute statistics like the peak number density or peak correlations, well, we need to deal with the peak density, and the peak density, because it's a point-like process, is basically defined as a superposition of Dirac delta, okay? So we only count the points where I actually have a local density maximum. And so there is a nice trick, which actually was found by Kak and Rice 50 years ago, which allows you to convert this sum of Dirac delta into the following product of Dirac delta and Heaviside function. All right, so let me translate. You know, let me explain what is here. Here you have the Dirac delta of the first derivative. Of course, you want to have an extremum, so you want to count the point only if this vanishes, okay? In which case, this would contribute, okay? Okay, I'm not very clean with the fact that these are distributions here, okay? But I mean, just to illustrate. And then you have the constraint, the following constraint. So you want the three derivatives of the matrix of minus the second derivative to be positive. So if I order these three eigenvalues as lambda 1 bigger than lambda 2 bigger than lambda 3, then I want lambda 3 to be positive. Okay, that's why you have this Heaviside function here. And then you want to have a peak of a certain height. I said nu c, and that's the third condition. In front of this, you have a factor, like some volume factor that comes from, you know, moving to this to there, okay, basically. And so then, once you have this is great, right? Because you start from like an expression that has no obvious dependence on the field itself and its derivative to something that has a clear dependence on the field and its derivative. So you can now play basically with this and compute, you know, correlators of this quantity. Ah, one more thing. This R star cube is like a characteristic scale. Okay, so it comes from the ratio of two spectral moments. So it defines a scale which you can think of like as the basic, as the average distance between peaks. Okay, average inter-peak distance. So once you've done this, yeah, you can compute correlators of this object, you know. And the first thing to do, of course, is to compute the average of this quantity, which would give you the peak abundance or peak number density. So this was done in BBKS. And so here is what they found. They found that the average number density of peaks of a given height is this term, which I will explain now. So the first thing to retain here is that it's exponentially suppressed, of course, because they're assuming Gaussian initial conditions, which we know works well for our cosmology. And here are like a bit more details. So this V star is basically the volume, okay, of a peak, if you want. Okay, it's this R cube. And then you have a gamma 1, which is a dimensionless number that takes values between 0 and unity. So this gamma 1 depends on basically the shape of the smooth power spectrum. Okay, when the smooth power spectrum is sharply peaked on some range of scales, this gamma 1 will be close to unity, while when this smooth power spectrum is, you know, covers a wide range of wave numbers, then this gamma 1 will be close to 0. Okay, and then you have two like terms. Well, you have one more term, which is actually this one, which is an integral of this quantity. Okay, what I want to point out here is that the u that is here is minus the trace of the second derivative. You can think it as a curvature, okay, a scalar curvature. So it's a curvature of the peak. Okay. And here, unfortunately, it's in green, so you can't see. But what is written here is that you have two additional. Okay, you have a matrix you have a symmetric matrix. So you have six numbers. Three of them are angles, right? Euler angles, and three of them are these eigenvalues. I rewrote these eigenvalues, these three eigenvalues, into three different numbers. One of them is the peak curvature, and the two others are basically the peak ellipticity and prolateness. So the fact that the density profile around the peak is not exactly spherical, but you know. So here you have the ellipticity and here you have the prolateness. You integrate over all the possible, you know, configuration of the peak profile, and then you integrate over all the possible configuration for the curvature, and you get the number density of peaks of a given height. Okay?
Did you say about capital F?
So that's a factor that is related to the fact that you have a determinant of you remember when I converted this sum of Dirac delta to, so you had the determinant. So here you have some factors that, okay. This is for, okay, fine. So now let's go, we did it. So BBKS did it for the peak number density, and they tried to do it for the two-point correlation, but they made a very wild approximation, which was of course it's the calculation is long. So which was in that they had already done a lot of calculations, you know, to get to this. So they said, okay, let's make an approximation. We will neglect basically all the interesting terms, okay? So there is not much to read in BBKS about the two-point correlation, but all the rest is very interesting, of course. So because we started from BBKS and we didn't have to go all what they did, we could, you know, go a bit further, and that's what we tried to do. And so we tried to compute the two-point correlation of these peaks up to second order. So here's what we found, okay? We managed after quite a few attempts, you know, to get an expression that we think is free of bugs, okay? What I want to say is that, so I wrote everything in terms of R, which is the separation basically between two peaks, okay, of this field. And I generalized these spectral moments into like these correlators where, you know, you have an extra spherical Bessel function, okay, there, okay? So it looks, interesting, but the question is, what's the physical meaning of this? Okay, what does this mean? So there is something here, if I look at this, that looks a bit like local bias, the local bias I told you about. Why? Because you see here, this psi not is basically the correlation of the smooth mass density field, okay? Which I would get if I start from local Lagrangian bias, okay? But then you get these obscure expressions, which I will explain shortly, okay? But first, let me focus on this piece. Okay, put it in green even. So what the first interesting thing you find here is that so you have bias parameters that look like your local bias. But the main difference is that while in standard Lagrangian bias, these bias parameters are just numbers. They might only depend on halo mass. Here you have like bias parameters that depend on scale. So if I go to Fourier space, it's easier to find the scale dependence. And the scale dependence goes like a constant plus something time k squared for the linear bias. While, well, of course, you have like a peak constraint. So you have the curvature of the density fields that comes in. The curvature is a second derivative, brings a factor of k squared. Okay, so that's very likely where it comes from. Same story, you have a second order bias. And here again, you have like constant piece plus terms that depend like k squared, also because of a peak constraint. I wrote down what are these coefficients, these bias coefficients. I don't want to discuss them here too much. I want to come to the point so that this term could be thought of as arising from a local bias expansion, the same way, the same I was discussing before. But I'm insisting on effective local bias expansion. Why did I write effective? Because you raised the point that what I'm looking at are points. It's not a continuous density field. So this thing here, you see, there is no scale right there. There is no cell size. There is nothing. So this thing does not exist. Okay, it's not physically measurable, right? But it's just like some quantity that you can use in order to compute at least this piece of the two-point correlation very quickly, right? What will you do? Basically, I'm claiming that I can write down this so that there is an effective piece, then peak density that is also like that has like a Taylor expansion, like in the local bias model. But I get extra terms at first order, okay? Because I have the peak constraints, I have a dependence on the peak curvature at first order, and then I have these products at second order, blah, blah. And then if I compute the correlator of this, I will get to this, okay, very basically easily. Instead of, you see, instead of having 10 variables at one point, okay, density, one density, three first derivative, six second derivative, so it's 10. So you have 20, if you want to compute the peak two-point correlation, you need to play with 20 variables, right? And then you have to integrate over this probability distribution, okay? You don't want to do this, you want to go fast, so you can do this, okay? But this gives you only that piece of the peak two-point correlation. So the question is, what about the other terms, okay? What time is it? Okay, thank you. So let me go to the third part of the talk. Now I will explain what are these other terms. So it took me actually 2 years to realize what they are, because actually there was a bug in the calculation. That's also one of the reasons. But the expression that I wrote here is correct. So let me just show you, okay, in case. Well, the bug was here is that this thing was missing. It was in our calculation, but in the final results, we just forgot it somewhere. We lost track of it, and it was missing. And then I really was very puzzled by this term because it looked very weird. And I only realized recently that it should be there, and I found that actually it's there, right? But anyway, so let's go back to... No, I don't use, you cannot trust it. No, I do it to check some stuff, but I do this, I mean, I do this by hand usually, actually. But I will show you that you can get to a result without, you know, just by simple considerations. So let's start with the first thing we know. We know that we want to model the density, you know, the distribution of a point process, and we know that this is invariant under rotations, right? So what we expect is that then the peak number density should depend on rotational invariance. Okay, so the first of them is the peak height, okay, just the normalized density. The second we could think of is the peak curvature, the trace, which we have seen seems to show up. But these are not the only invariants. Well, there are other invariants that I can construct with the variables I'm playing with, right? And so there are actually three other invariants. The first of them is the gradient squared, okay, of the density. The fourth is the trace of the traceless matrix of second derivative squared, okay? And the last one is the determinant. Okay, so for those of you who know a bit these Newton identities, these things are, you know, can be constructed like, I mean, this thing could be written as a trace of a matrix to the third minus matrix squared, etc. Okay, whatever, okay? What I'm arguing now is that actually this determinant is not relevant here. Why? Because I have a Gaussian random field. I have exponential of quadratic quantities. That's what these probability distributions are. So because I have quadratic quantities in the exponential, I claim that I cannot have like a third order quantity, okay, playing. So I claim that this is not here because of Gaussian initial condition. Or at least it can show up only as a like volume factor in the computation, okay? So now let's play a bit with these quantities, these rotational invariants. Let's compute these, the correlators, okay? The two-point correlators. So here I wrote, I put subscripts here, one and two, and what I mean is that one of the field is defined at position x1 and the other one at position x2, okay? I can compute them, and here is what I found. The point is that actually, I will, if I go back to the big expression I just showed you before for the peak to point, I will find these correlators there, okay? Like this one, look at this one, okay? This one is precisely, it's precisely here, okay? Well, nearly. Yes, it's here, okay? And all the others, okay? So it seems that actually, so eta 1 squared is basically the gradient squared at position x1, and eta 2 squared is the gradient squared at position x2. So if you do this game, you will find that you will find all these expressions in the big result, right? But without this. What is this one here? It's just the zero lag contribution. It's when x1 equals x2. Okay? So you find them there, but without the zero lag contribution. Let me go on. So then the question arises so it seems that I could write down a local expansion with like rotational invariance.
This is smoothing a scale, it's kind of arbitrary if we did it by hand. But I mean, don't you expect like the potential to come in?
No, so the smoothing scale that comes here is basically the halo mass scale.
Sure.
Of course,
right.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering, physically you only expect to have derivatives of the potential because that's a tidal field.
Oh, right. So here the approximation is spherical collapse. Spherical collapse is basically a local approximation to this highly nonlinear gravitational process, right? And so in this approximation, collapse depends only on the local density. But if I could consider actually a more realistic model of collapse, and then I would have the tidal field, so second derivatives of the potential. But I don't want to go into this trouble here, but it's absolutely right. So I can, so now the question is, so it seems that I can compute everything just by playing with these rotational invariants. Then the question is, then what are the bias parameters associated with these rotational invariant terms, okay? The new that I found. So let's go back to the probability distribution. So we look at the one point, okay? So I told you we have 10 variables. So this is how it looks like for Gaussian random field. And then I can compute this quadratic form, which is given by the inverse covariance matrix, okay, as usual. And this is how it looks like, okay? It looks like this, a piece that depends on u and u, and then eta squared and zeta squared. That's why I told you there is no depth of zeta in the story, at least because of Gaussian initial condition. And it turns out that you can write down this probability distribution as follows. You can write down as a joint, a bivariate normal distribution, okay, for nu and u, times a chi-square distribution with 3 degrees of freedom for this piece, and a chi-square with 5 degrees of freedom for that piece, times, of course, 5 angles. But what are these angles? Actually, I don't care about them. There are 2 angles that are associated with the vector here, and there are 3 angles associated with this matrix, and I claim that I don't need to worry about them because I'm interested in quantities invariant of the rotation, so they won't do anything to the bias, okay? So I ignore them. Here I wrote down the bivariate normal and chi-square distribution in case you don't remember how they look like. And you can actually test it, of course, it must be the case. Right? So the claim now is that the bias factors are basically ensemble average of derivative, so the bias factors Bij, they are associated with the variables nu and u. Why do I use two indices here? That's because nu and u are correlated. Okay? And so what I claim is that these bias factors, and actually you can check that, we'll find that the Bij that I was showing before, they can actually be computed at ensemble average of these Hermite polynomials. And these Hermite polynomials, they are basically the orthogonal polynomials associated with this bivariate Gaussian, and are just given by this. And so how do I generalize this to the chi-squared variables, eta squared and zeta squared? Well, I claim that the same logic must apply. And so here, I wrote down, but I use also two indices just for shorthand convenience. Here, I wrote down bias parameters associated with the variable eta squared, and I claim that these bias parameters, they are ensemble average of Laguerre polynomials, which are the orthogonal polynomials associated with chi-squared distribution. And same story for zeta squared, but here you have 3 degrees of freedom, while there you have 5 degrees of freedom. Okay? And then you can test this because you have the exact result, which you know you computed without understanding exactly what you were doing, right? But you can then test, you know, at least you didn't have any prior, you know, on all this, right? And it turns out that it works exactly, right? So you find, so chi10 is the first order bias parameters associated with the rotational invariant eta squared. Remember the gradient delta squared. And so this is given by the ensemble average of a first order Laguerre, and this is what you would get. That's basically the ensemble average of this quantity at the peak position minus 3. If I was looking at random points, then this thing would just be 3, right? Because the mean of a chi-square distribution with 3 degrees of freedom is 3. So I would have no bias, but because I sit at the position of maxima, I have a bias because this thing is not equal to 3. And what is this thing at the position of maxima? It's 0 because eta squared, the gradient of delta, is always 0. Okay, so I get 0 minus 3, so I get minus 3 half of this, okay? Same story here. If I was just considering random field points, again, I would get 5 here for chi-squared, so no bias. But because I sit at the position of density maxima, I don't get 0, and I get this. And then look at this term, okay? That's what I get after some calculation, and I found it. It's exactly... Okay, you have this term. So these are the bias parameters associated with this zeta squared. Okay, here you have the term squared because you have the correlation of zeta squared with itself at two different positions. And there you, and here you have a piece that does not depend on this, and that's just the eta squared with itself and the bias 3/2. Okay, and then everything basically works. Believe me. So at the end, my physical interpretation of this. So do I told you about peak background split at the beginning, and that I can view these peak background split biases as, you know, arising from modulation of like a homogeneous distribution by long wavelength perturbation. So this would work for, so I can generalize this to the chi-squared variable, right? What I have is that the bias parameters associated with these chi-squared variables, they basically come from long wavelength perturbation, okay, of these fields. And so what do I get when I perturb a chi-square distribution? I get a non-central chi-square distribution. And right, when I expand a non-central chi-square distribution, I can write down the series expansion in terms of Laguerre polynomials, and I find the bias parameters there, right? Okay, so I can generalize basically this idea of peak background split just to derive all these things very easily, okay? So the main ingredients are basically rotational invariance and this peak background split, and then one more word about the physical meaning of the zeta squared term. So this bias is related to the fact that peaks are not spherical, okay? It's a quantification of the asphericity of the density profile around peaks. So Bardin et al. Made the following calculation 30 years ago. So they found that, here is what they are showing. So here they are showing the ellipticity divided by the curvature, and I wrote in red what I use as variables here. Okay, I use V divided by U, why they use this. And here they are showing the prolateness. And they plot the contours of the distribution of ellipticity and prolateness as a function of peak height. And basically here you go from low to increasing peak height. And when the peak, the height of the peak becomes very large, then you get to a distribution that is very close to spherical. Okay? And that's basically, and so if you compute chi 0, 1, so this first order bias, basically what you will find is that if you go to very large peak height, then it goes very close to zero because the profile is very close to spherical. Okay, there is no contribution. Why? When you start deviating, you know, from spherical sphericity of the profile, then you get a contribution to the bias. Okay? Okay, this is just a plot to show you how these various bias parameters up to second order look like. So you have the B10, which would be the usual B1 of the standard local bias. Okay, you have the B01, and there at second order you have five bias parameters. The point here, the only thing to remember here is that unless you have very high peaks, all the bias parameters will contribute. Okay, so you're never in the usual local bias approximation. Okay? And so to conclude this part, I claim that so you can compute the correlation, this two-point correlation of density peaks, just starting from this effective local bias expansion with bias coefficient computed from a peak background split argument. And then I just compute the correlator of this with itself if I want a two-point. And I must ignore at the end all the zero-lag contribution, and then I claim that I get the right result. So it's basically here, I tested this, okay, actually effectively, right? And I claim that it works for any point process of any Gaussian random field, okay? As long as the point process is specified as a set of localized constraints. What I mean is that the density, you know, can be written as a product of delta Dirac and Heaviside functions and all that, okay? Then, say fine, so let's move to the third part if you still have a bit of, it's okay.
So are you
no, I want to show you a practical application, okay, of all this mess, okay?
There's no more shot noise in this model. It's not like you're picking galaxies out from some hypothetical probability distribution and Poisson sampling.
Right, so here there is no Poisson
sampling. Just exact locations. You're a peak or you're not a peak.
Exactly. I know exactly where they are. Of course, when I have so to model galaxies in this framework, you would have to do like, you could do HOD, right? So, I mean, what here I claim that I can give you is basically a very good description of the position of the virialized halos at redshift 0, 1, okay? Then if you want to model galaxies on top of this, you could combine this model with HOD, right? Because it works exactly the same way. Right? It's exactly this, it looks like a local bias expansion, it's a slightly more complicated, but we have the same argument, peak background split, and we can basically put all this in the machinery we have now and make, I believe, more accurate predictions. But now let me just show. Well, but I compute a three-point out of this. I claim that I can compute a three-point. Instead of computing a three-point correlation for peaks, like doing all these integrals, I claim that I can start from this effective local bias.
The point is that you said you don't have the zero lag, and the zero lag is exactly the Poisson noise.
No, that's not the Poisson noise.
The zero lag is the Poisson noise. The zero lag correlation.
Well, okay, that's not what I would call the Poisson noise, right? That's just. The reason why these terms are not there is because you have an inverse covariance matrix. It's actually, you start by, you have these variables at position one are correlated with those variables at position two, and what you have in the middle is an inverse covariance matrix. And it basically, well, let me just say something a bit more about that. Let's ignore everything and keep only the density. If I only keep the density, what are the bias parameters? They are average over these orthogonal polynomials, in which case Hermite polynomials. And so how would I compute the result if I had only the density? Well, I would compute the two-point correlator and then ignore. So I would have something like then that would be simple. Okay. And then the two-point, I claim it's this. So I would get B1 squared times this, but there I would get other corrections. okay? Because I could take a 3 with a 1, and that would contribute here. Okay, my claim is that they're not there, okay? And I know that with this model, because I can do an explicit calculation, that they are not here. So in some sense, I should think of this local bias expansion as being expansion, if in some sense, in terms of like, here I don't have like delta, but I have like orthogonal sets, like in quantum mechanics, okay? So what would they be here? They would be actually Hermite polynomials, right? So I should not write B1 delta, but I should write B1 times H1 of delta, and then H2 of delta, and then H3 of delta, etc. And then when I compute the correlator of this with itself at two different positions, then the H1, because these things are orthonormal, will only correlate with the H1, so I will only get a term like that and not basically terms that arise because of zero lag moments. That's what I meant. Okay, so then the question is, how do you generalize this when you have several variables? But that's basically, I think, the idea.
My point was just that there is a zero lag term that is not modeled in the 2-point convergent function that goes, and that corresponds to Poisson. So if you add, so you have a deterministic relationship, right, between delta and delta. So if I just add Poisson knowledge to it, then it's not going to show up in the 2-point convergent function except at zero lag.
Right, but I'm not hiding Poisson noise, okay? Well, we can discuss this later if you want, okay? I just want to show you now, I just want to convince you that there is connection with this and with actually what you can measure in numerical simulation. So let me just ask the question, the following question. So can I predict the ELO counts, so ELO mass function or ELO abundance from like physical, you know, arguments? So, I mean, these days there are, you know, various formula, and this formula, of course, they have some physical motivation, but there is always a part where you have to fit, okay, something. The question is that which level can we go? And what I want to show you is that I can start with these peaks and actually get a pretty good description of the Hilbert mass function. So that's, that you should view it as a cross, like a proof of a principle, okay, rather that, okay, but just to show you how it goes. So the point is that, let's go back to the figure that I had before. So this is a halo. I took it from this Aquarius project. So it's a simulation of a massive cluster at very high resolution. And so what you see is that, you see that here you go and move to the center of the massive cluster, but inside this big halo, there are many, many substructures, okay? So actually when we compute the halo mass function, I'm just explaining for those who might not know about this, okay? Because I don't know if there are particle physicists in the room or not. But when we talk about the halo mass function, we always talk about the abundance of the biggest hosting halo, okay? I'm ignoring all the substructure inside halos, okay? So the question is, how do I model the abundance of this biggest hosting halo, okay? So I must be careful because I don't want this halo to be embedded in an even larger halo, okay? That's an extra condition which I didn't take into account until now. So I have to enforce it. So how do I do that? The first thing that I will do is what I was doing before. I will smooth the linear density field on the halo mass scale, okay? That's basically what this means. Then I will select all peaks with height nu equals nu c, and I will enforce the following condition, okay? I will say that if I slightly increase the size of the filter, then the density at that position will be less than delta C, the critical density, while if I slightly decrease it, then it's above. So basically, at that point, the density crosses the critical threshold. Okay, and I claim that this is basically approximate, but good way to take into account the fact that I don't want this object to be embedded in a bigger halo. Right, it's not. So I'm not giving too many details because I think Ravi might talk about this in 3 weeks. But basically, this is, you can actually motivate this because what you find is that when you actually in the range, the range of peak height with nu of the order of unity or larger, you actually find that random walks that don't cross the threshold as R increase at a certain position will actually never cross it again, or the probability is very small. While that's because when you use filters like Topaz or Gaussian, you have works that are strongly correlated, and so it's very difficult then to go back, cross again and again down. That's the reason. That's basically the physical argument. And they tested this with simulation of random works and found that it works pretty well. Okay, but I agree, okay? Basic, but at least it's easy to implement, okay? Why? Because we just have to consider an extra variable. So basically here the idea is what? You take your peak formalism and you combine it with excursion set, okay? So Ravi, I'm not giving too many details. I leave this for Ravi, okay? What I want to say is that there is basically this amount to introducing a new variables in the problem. And what is this variable? It's this. It's the derivative of the density with respect to the filter size, okay? Again, it's an invariant order rotation, so I expect that it will contribute to the bias and the clustering of these peaks, okay? So you can show actually that all this, basically, you can write down a new number density, localized number density in terms of the old one, which is this product of Dirac delta and Heaviside. And what you have on top, or in front of this, you have a Heaviside of mu, which means that you want to select works that upcross the threshold at that point when R, the filter size decreases. That's what this means, okay? And not the others, okay? And then you play with this, that's basically, okay? So you can write an effective bias expansion that is more complicated, but okay. And then you can write down the first crossing distribution in terms of the number of upcrossing at a given filtering scale, and you can relate this to the halo abundance. Okay, so you get a prediction for the halo abundance once you know this, and this, you can predict it. But wait, there is a last subtlety, and then I will stop, okay? As some of you mentioned, collapse is not exactly spherical, okay? So when it comes, when it goes to excursion set theory, for those who know what this is, what we have is that we actually have a collapse barrier that is fuzzy, and that is not flat, and it, okay, and stochastic and moving, okay? Right, so you could do that. We didn't, so what we did, I will show you what we did. Right, so let me show you the plot that actually exemplifies just what you said. So that's the, so this is a plot showing, it's showing the variance, the RMS variance for a given halo mass scale and the linear, let me restart. I take a halo in the final, okay, snapshot. I trace this halo back to the initial conditions, and then I smooth the linear density field on the same halo mass scale, and I take note of the linear density extrapolated to redshift zero at that position. You follow me? That's this first thing. For each halo, I do that. And then I plot this versus the RMS variance of the linear density field on that mass scale. So here I go from very, very massive halos, sigma is very small, strong smoothing, to low mass halos, because sigma is increasing, smoothing is becoming softer. And here I have a scatter plot. Each point corresponds to one halo in the simulation. This was done by Robertson, Kravtsov, et al. In 2009. So the blue horizontal line is the spherical collapse prediction. And as you see, you converge to the spherical collapse prediction as you go to very, very massive halos. But for realistic halos, you're always away. You're always above. Why are you above? Ellipsoidal collapse, right? Because you have, actually, you have, you know, you have basically tides, you know, tidal fields that tend to disrupt the collapse of the halo. So you need like a larger initial density in order to collapse, okay? That's basically what's going on, okay? And here you have fits, okay? The point is that what I told you so far is basically assuming that all these points lie exactly here, okay? So what we did in order to take this into account in the first approximation is basically to assume that the distribution of delta C at the position of a peak is not exactly 1.68, but it's given by a fit to this scatter plot. So we didn't follow the ellipsoidal collapse. We could have done this, but it was already going to, you know, being too complicated. The assumption is that—
Because where you are in that gray scatter,
exactly.
Properties,
yeah, and exactly. You could predict, but it was just, at this stage, it was too complicated. That's something one could do on. like one could do next, and actually we want to do it. But so what we did is that we assume that the ellipsoidal collapse is basically uncorrelated with the bias and all that. And so we just simply fit this result, and then we incorporate the distribution of delta C given an ELO mass in the prediction, You follow me? And so you find that Robertson et al. Found that this distribution is basically close to log normal. So I repeat, this is the spherical collapse prediction, and I had a contribution that is log normally distributed according to these findings. It's not, But once I do that, I have no free parameter, Because I have the, I must take the fit of Robertson. Why? Because we identify the halos in the exact same way with its spherical over density. Yes. Okay. And now let me just to conclude show you the predictions of the model for the mass functions. So we used like a couple of box size to test this. So we had like 1500 and 250. These are measurements at achieve zero. So here I'm showing the relative the difference between the simulation and the theoretical prediction. The flat horizontal curve is our prediction. And the dashed is the fit of Tinker. And I'm not claiming that our prediction is, very excellent, but I think it's very encouraging, right? Because it's within 10% of what we observe. And I think what is more important is that I think we really make, physically sensible approximation. We count ELOs, what usually you don't do when you do excursion set. When you do excursion set, you take all random walks, And then you compute some like average or this way, that way. And here we really try to count ELOs the same way you could count ELOs in a simulation. And we use, I think, physically sensible prescription. But I agree that all this could be, improved. So just two different box sizes. So this one is smaller, so we could go to lower ELO mass in resolution. And we are using, we are basically identifying ELOs with this spherical over density prescription exactly as Robertson and Kravtsov-Tinker did, of course. Otherwise, we would not use their scatter plot for the prediction. And we also tested this at redshift one just for consistency. And that's it. So what you can do, actually, you can also measure all these bias parameters, which maybe Ravi will discuss this. I don't know. I will conclude here because I think well, time to conclude. Just to summarize, if you have to take something back home, then this is what you should take back home. So initial density peaks describe pretty well, I think, the formation site of ELOs with mass larger than M star. That's from simulation. And the, what is important is that you can, so the clustering of density peaks looks very difficult to compute, but actually I try to convince you that it's pretty simple, right? You can write down this effective bias expansion, compute the bias parameters with this peak background split argument, and then everything is easy. And then you can combine all this with excursion set, and you could also combine this with HOD to get even more accurate prescription for the clustering of ELOs and hopefully galaxies. So thank you very much for your attention. Well, actually, people are not doing it at the moment, but there is one model, which is the, redshift space distortions. So, it's what you actually observe is more complicated than what I was describing here, of course, because you have on top of, the position in space, you have like the peculiar velocity along the line of sight, which creates this Doppler shift on top of the cosmological redshift, which, so we look like distortions in your correlation maps. And so Taruya and then Nishimishi and S. Saito developed a model, and they actually found out that when you had a k-squared term to the linear bias, they just did it at the end of their paper, they found that this improves very much the agreement with the data, the simulation data they were using, right? But I mean, so people are slowly starting, to consider these corrections. We are still far from having, something that is fully understood and accurate. But, if we want, if we want to, take a survey like Euclid, $1 billion, If you want to get something from this $1 billion, then you know you will really have to work hard on the theory, because we are looking for really, you know, small deviations from like the standard model, right, basically, huh? And that's going to be tough. So we must consider all these things, I think.
So you did mention something about the three-point function and how you can get it in this way. I mean, do you expect predictions for extracting non-Gaussian energy from large-scale structure surveys to improve by taking into account all of these assumptions?
Right. So.
Or like, how much improvement does that teach you?
So some people claim, before the Planck data came out, they claim, including myself actually, they claim that large-scale structure on the long run will do better on non-Gaussianity. So we have to, yeah, we have to show that it's actually true, right? So that's one way, you know, one step further, because all these scale dependencies, they can mimic, you know, scale dependence from primordial non-Gaussianity. So yeah.
First, this is my approach to dealing with nonlinearities, actually kind of formation. I guess the other thing that people do is this effective field theory approach. Have you heard of this?
So effective field theory was developed for the mass density field, not for a biased tracer of the density field. Because the problem is there is that you're resumming many terms, and so you will start resumming terms with different bias orders, and then it's not completely clear what's going on, right? But I mean, in this case, what you would do is you would not use effective field theory, but you could use Lagrangian perturbation theory, for instance, a la Matsubara, because it's very easy to write down what you call renormalized bias parameters. It's trivial to write them down, and then you can just plug your expression, basically this expression, into its prediction. That would be one way to incorporate this with perturbation theory. Relatively easy.
Okay, if there are no more questions for Vincent, so he's going to be here until Friday morning. So if you want to talk to him, his office is 469.
469, yeah.
Something like that, yeah. Okay, and you're welcome to join us for dinner this evening as well. Thank you.
Thank you.